Welcome to the Product Design Podcast. I'm your host, Seth Coolin, founder of UX Cabin, where we create world-class web and mobile apps. I'm excited to bring you a behind-the-scenes look into the lives of some of the most interesting and talented people in product design. We'll get strategic advice on how they got to where they are today and things they wish they would have known earlier in their career. Hey, everybody. Thanks for joining us on the Product Design Podcast. Today, we have Cheryl Kababa with us. She is the Chief Strategy Officer at Substantial. Cheryl has recently written a book on systems thinking, and we are going to get into an awesome talk on all things systems thinking, design, product, UX, and get to know Cheryl a little bit. So, Cheryl, why don't you go ahead and tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do.
Yeah, so I'm Cheryl Kababa. My pronouns is she and her. I am the Chief Strategy Officer at Substantial, which is a research strategy and software development firm primarily based in Seattle, but we have practitioners, you know, pretty much all over the US and Canada. And yeah, I'm focused on driving our design research and strategy practice, which is focused primarily on education. And I think in terms of the work that I've been doing, let's say, like if I'm working backwards and thinking about my career, I've been a design consultant or design research and strategy consultant for about the past 10 years. And that before that, I was a UX and product designer, and I worked for companies like Microsoft and also Philips Design. And so I have sort of like a very much a generalist attitude towards being a design practitioner and also being a consultant. I worked on within a lot of different domains on a lot of different products and services, which I think has informed my approach to systems thinking. So that's kind of my professional background in a nutshell.
Very cool. How did you get involved in the space to begin with?
In systems thinking or just like in design?
Yeah, just like in design.
Yeah, I actually do not have a design degree. I have a journalism degree as well as a political science degree. And I did a thesis in design, and I think it was kind of interesting kind of coming out of school. I ended up going straight into the technology sector, and mainly because I had kind of taught myself how to code, and I was just kind of like building websites for myself and ended up getting hired by Microsoft a couple of years out of college. And so kind of combining sort of my interest in design and basically kind of learning within the practice. And I feel like what, you know, we now describe as user experience design was felt really nascent. Like we were just starting to do things like usability research and things like that. And so kind of being at the beginning of that, I felt like I was in this space in hindsight of helping to shape the practice. Right. And so I think that experience, and then I just continued doing software product design for basically kind of like the next decade after that. And I think that whole experience, it's really interesting kind of like how I ended up being a design researcher kind of intersects like almost like full circle with my experience as in my early career as a journalist, because there is like this idea of like drawing out people's stories and taking an empathic approach to what people are experiencing and their context. But, you know, of course, like with journalism, it's about telling stories. And with design research, it's about informing products and services. And so that sort of like Venn diagram of like both like my experiences and my strengths kind of like really came to fruition when I ended up being a design researcher. I never really, it's like, it's interesting because then I ended up applying like sort of my skills in user experience design more so to things like creating visual frameworks and, I don't know, shaping experiences for the organizations and like product teams that I was working with. So kind of thinking about concept design, using concept design within the realm of design research, but not really like going forward and kind of being the designer who's like shipping a product. And I know like there are different designers who find that space really difficult because it's like you might never see what you're designing out in the world in real life for people to use. But I don't know, it just kind of like lit up all of like my interests and also felt like I was getting in the front end of decision making. So that's where people are making decisions about things like the business model and what have you when you're doing an actual like design strategy work. So yeah, that's, you know, long story, that's how I kind of ended up in the design practice, basically from my non-design oriented educational background.
Yeah, that's really cool. How did you find your job at Microsoft? Did you pursue that or did you just meet the right person at the right time or how did that happen?
Yeah, that was definitely a meeting the right person at the right time. One of my friends was working with me at the Seattle Times and then he ended up going to Microsoft because he was doing kind of like data visualization work and was like, hey, you should come over here. Like, you know how to like build websites and stuff. And I ended up just like, I don't know. I feel like I was really lucky. I kind of like, you can't do this today, of course. Like, you're not going to be hired to just like lightly code websites because you taught yourself how to do it. I had built some things for the Seattle Times, which is where I was working. And I guess those were good enough to go over to Microsoft and hire. This was like, I'm telling myself in terms of my age. This was in the 90s. So it was like, yeah, if you knew, it was like everybody was just kind of inventing the internet at that time. Right? So also this, like, you know, if you know HTML, come on over. Yeah.
Totally. That's awesome. No, I think life is all about those little opportunities where you have to like, you know, either make a jump or be content doing what you're doing. And it's like, yeah, I mean, personally for me, a lot of those jumps have always, you know, been kind of what leads to a bigger and better door. And it's kind of, you know, feels kind of scary. You're doing something that might be comfortable to you or might be fine, but just being like, oh, I want to see what's on the other side of this door. And then going in and be like, wow, now this opens up a bunch of new opportunities for me to like, you know, go and explore and do other things from here.
Yeah. Yeah. And I kind of think like in some ways, like I feel like I have a relatively short attention span. So I never thought I'd be able to make it through writing a book, for example, but I can talk a little bit about that later. But I think what's kind of lit up for me in terms of the design practice is that my career has been able to kind of shift based on the changes, not just the changes in the practice, but I have the privilege of having been able to kind of follow my interests within the design practice. So if I was like in an organization, you know, I worked at Philips Design for a long time. They're based in the Netherlands. I feel like design in general is like a really mature discipline there. And so you see a lot of, I don't know what you call like silos within the discipline. So you could be like, at the time when I was working there, it's like, okay, you could be an information architecture. You could be a design researcher, which sits over here. You can be an interaction designer, which kind of sits over here. And I think I ended up in this like weird like slot of like being an information architect. And I was like, am I not? I don't know if I am. I and I had come from the States and I was like, oh, I'm a generalist. I sometimes do even like, I run usability studies. I like design screens and prototypes. I do all of that. But it was kind of like, no, we have people who do those things. Like you sit here and you work with other people within the design field. And I found that really hard because like, I kind of wanted to learn how to do all of these things. You know, we always talk about T-shaped designer who is like, you run deep in one area, like interaction design, but you can kind of carry through like all of those things. I feel like it was more like I-shaped in those environments in which I worked. But then I went to consultancy. I ended up at Adapted Path, who, you know, are based in San Francisco, but they opened up a studio, a very small studio in Amsterdam. And I got to do a lot of that design generalist kind of work where it was like, I'm a researcher, but I'm also doing some design strategy work. I was doing a little bit of like, I don't know, teaching or what we call capacity building within organizations, like teaching them how to do design research. And then also doing like screen concept prototypes, right? And I felt like, oh, this is the place for me because then I can like sort of experiment, dabble in all these different places, but then kind of find areas where I want to build expertise. So now I'm not really doing any screen design whatsoever, you know, but I can still fall into the space of being like a design director for that work, but I can also be a design director for strategy work or research projects or what have you. And I think that sort of like, I don't know if using like T-shape is just like that sort of horizontal experience that I've had across the design practice, I think has made me more perceptive of where the changes in the design practice are happening. And so I think it was interesting, especially with systems thinking, I started integrating it into my work several years ago, like some of the methods like causal loop diagramming and things like that. And I think there was a point where it was like, you know, myself included and other people are like, why are you doing this? What does it lead to? And, but then I think like in terms of like pitching this as a book, I really saw a gap in terms of like, okay, when somebody like me wanted to engage in systems thinking within my own practice, I really had to kind of like, I don't know, wander the wilderness a little bit of like, oh my gosh, how much time and energy is this kind of method going to take? Like, this is so abstract and it's hard for me as somebody who's been in an empathy driven practice. So I think it's just things like that. I can sort of create a direction for my career kind of based on like where I sort of see things going and what I'm interested in learning.
Very cool. Yeah. I mean, for those who are new to the topic of systems thinking, maybe you could just go ahead and give us a little like 10,000 foot overview of what it is.
Yeah. So I really think about it as a mindset shift for designers. So it's the acknowledgement that whatever it is that you're working, I think the way I want to describe it is a little bit in the context of the design practice, because I could describe systems thinking as everybody understands it, which is like a system is sort of like an entity made out of many parts. And it basically functions in a way, it has forces within it, in which, you know, it results in certain outcomes. And so the system behaves in a way that is counter to the way humans inside it might behave or the attitudes humans inside it might behave. And so I think there's, you know, that kind of perspective, which is generally what a system is. But I think the way I like to describe it, because I think of my audience as designers who want to engage in systems thinking, it's really a mindset shift that's oriented around, you know, these, what I call three concepts of systems thinking. One is recognizing that everything is interconnected. So if you're working on an app, for example, let's say you're working on a banking app, that banking app, it does not stand by itself. It's not an interaction between the thing you're designing and just the user you're designing it for. There are entities involved. There's like background processing when it comes to like the banking information coming into your app. There are, you know, the variety of stakeholders. Like if you're working for a fintech company, you're going to be dealing with like the regulatory environment, for example. So it's like knowing that there are all these entities outside of what you're doing that can affect what you're doing, and they are interconnected. There's also so interconnectedness, first concept. The second concept is causality. So understanding that there's not just like, for example, a direct benefit of use of the thing that you're designing. There are things that will happen afterwards before things are, or after things are out of your control. So this could be intended and unintended consequences. And we kind of see those kinds of things happening at scale. Anytime you see anything kind of like going wrong with like Facebook, like, you know, you think about like how like platforms like Facebook have affected elections, for example. That's like both, you could view that as intended and unintended consequences, you know, like how people get radicalized, etc. And then lastly, there's wholeness. So kind of like thinking about the system in as holistic a way as possible. So just like kind of going beyond, I mean, I think this is connected to interconnectedness, and it's kind of like, how far out does this system go? Like, what does it cover? What does it entail? I do a lot of projects in education. And so oftentimes I have to be thinking like far beyond like how a student or a teacher might experience a product or service, but also think about like, what do government entities that set policy for education, like how do they have an impact on this? How does like the IT director of a large school district, like how do they have an impact on this? And just kind of thinking about like, how far out do you need to go in order to understand like, what are the things that may have an impact on this, as well as like either facilitate or prevent its success? And also like, are there like points of innovation within that system that maybe we aren't acknowledging if we're thinking about kind of like the a very narrow version of like the work that we're doing?
Wow. So is systems thinking something that is more so just something that helps you think deeply about your projects and have a better awareness? Or are there tangible things that you employ that you say, hey, as part of a systems thinking exercise, we're going to do, you know, this deliverable or this exercise? Or is it more of just a thought experiment?
Yeah, I mean, it could be either. I mean, I think it definitely starts with the mindset shift, like just kind of thinking about like, even just like broadening, for example, who you think your stakeholders are on your project, whether they're organizational or whether they are who you think your users are. So like in my work in education, for example, we oftentimes think about like, who are the student groups or populations who are most marginalized in the current education system? And how can we take a lens on like how they experience products and services? Because kind of doing the work to make their experience better is very likely to benefit others who have more privilege than them. This is like kind of like an aspect of, you know, what we might call universal design. You kind of design things like curb cuts for folks with disabilities, but others will benefit from it too, like somebody who's pushing a stroller or a cart or something like that, who can't just like hop up and step over that. So is like taking that approach design, I think, is a form of systems thinking, even if it's not like, oh, it's part of formal systems thinking methodology or whatever. Just having the mindset to engage in that kind of like thinking around who your stakeholders are is a form of systems thinking. But there are also really good tools that you can draw from formalized systems thinking practices. And these mostly fall into the category of systems mapping for me, because designers actually have a really good superpower in terms of being able to think visually and to be able to depict things visually. So there are quite a few visual frameworks that can be employed to actually engage in systems thinking in your work. Like one of them is causal loop diagramming. So like creating these diagrams that show like how one thing leads to another. I think that I just drew one this morning as I was on a call with somebody, and I'm like trying to look at it now. It's like, okay, they're working for like a public college system in one of the states. And they said the smaller colleges in their state have had lower enrollment. And so they then cut programs, which leads to less student choice, which then leads to lower enrollment. So this is a good example of like a causal loop. And as I was kind of processing this information, this person was explaining to me, I was like drawing the causal loop because I was kind of like, oh, yeah, this is really interesting. It's like the notion that nothing we do that is part of like problem solving has the potential to result in other problems as well, right?
Yes.
So what is it? Peter Tsang, who wrote The Fifth Discipline, which is like a classic text in systems thinking, said yesterday's solutions lead to today's problems, because it's just like you're never done like problem solving. So I've started kind of thinking about it as navigating problems rather than solving them, because anything you come up with, you're going to have to potentially anticipate how it might do something that will cause additional problems or won't work as intended or what have you.
Yeah, no, I think that's a super, super good point. I think even just like realizing that, even just like a policy standpoint, right? Like, is the cure, you know, worse than the disease, right?
Right.
There's a lot of things that you know, people just say in a generalized way where we're like, oh, yeah, that sounds great. It's like, if that is really implemented or if that's really done, it's like, what are going to be the cascading effects of that? And it's like,
that's right.
From a project level standpoint, those are realities too, right? Like everything from the navigation to the information architecture to, you know, the color of the, you know, the contrast within your app, like all of these things are going to have cascading effects depending on who's using it, how it's deployed, all of those sorts of things.
Yeah, most definitely. And I think it's like, we're not always thinking about that, like when we're engaging in user experience design or what have you. Like, I think about how sometimes piecemeal, like sometimes our design processes are. I remember when I was working, for example, for doing like a lot of like, you know, work with banking clients. And I can't remember who said it, but like one of my colleagues was like, yeah, if you ever look at like the structure of a banking website, I can guarantee you it matches the structure of their organization. So if mortgages are way over here and they have no connection at all to like savings and checking or whatever, that's because like the mortgage team is over there doing their own thing. They have their own incentives. And that 100% affects how they present themselves, because like they're like, oh, add this feature over here. Like, I remember that actually. Right. Once I was like working on like a checking section of a banking website, and they were like, oh, the mortgage team needs like an ad for their service, like in this feature you're designing. And I was like, what? An ad? Like an ad for like another part of your organization. There's something going wrong here. These are not integrated services. And so that's a benefit of like doing some analysis where you can think about these things holistically, is like, okay, instead of just like slapping an ad in there, maybe there's a better way to integrate this for your customers that actually have like maybe a mortgage with your bank, but also have a savings account. Like, how do you make the experience better for them?
Yeah. Yeah. That's a fantastic point of balance, right? It's like, even the best teams who want to do like this iterative approach, because they don't want to do waterfall, because you want to get things out there, makes a lot of sense. But then like the downfall of doing really small little releases is that you get so myopic and you don't see the big picture and you can't consider everything and you can't just like, you know, holistically think how everything works and churns and, you know, all of the cogs. So yeah, I always think about that. It's like when you're really ingrained in like a super tight sprint cycle, you're like, I know we're going to redo this and everyone acknowledges we're going to redo this, but we just have to do it because it's part of the process. You know, and I'm not saying that's better or worse, or I'm not saying that's worse than just going away for 9 months, working on something and then boom, releasing it. Like that's its own problem. But
yeah,
I think we need to be also, yeah, kind of cognizant of not getting too myopic about these like small incremental feature release type of things.
Yeah, I think that's actually, that's a really good point of opportunity for just like a little bit of additional analysis, you know, where something sits within the boundaries of what you're designing. Because like, there's no going back to like, oh, the crazy like waterfall system where, you know, you designed everything in advance and then like you're engineers would go and build it. Like that doesn't,
right.
That it just doesn't make any sense. And also like so many problems arise that you're redesigning anyway.
Yeah.
So the incremental design is actually really smart, but how do we like gain that shared understanding to keep that sort of systems perspective in mind as we're kind of like going into those design sprints and making incremental change? It's funny, I've written this whole book. I don't have the answer for that, but it's a very interesting, like, I wonder if like, I think there are kind of useful tools in here that might help you kind of like maybe quickly kind of think about how things connect before, yeah, jumping in and making change, or being able to take advantage of those connections too, like as you're going into a design sprint, because like knowing a little bit more probably surfaces some things too that you might be like, oh, I didn't know these things were connected, or I didn't know that X percentage of people at this bank, like 30% of the people at this bank have a mortgage and they have a savings account. Like, we should be thinking about this in a way that serves them so that it feels like these things are connected. They're, it's at the same institution. So yeah. I think it's like, it is that perspective where it's like, maybe there's just like a little bit of analysis, even if it's just like, I don't know, a little bit of immersion or like fact gathering or something like that, that happens in like at the very front of a design sprint so that you can kind of like get to some of those broader issues.
Yeah. Yeah. I think one of the spicy topics that you kind of bring up in your, in the beginning of your book is the shortcomings of user-centered design. And, you know, that's obviously like a big, huge staple of UX, where it's like, we just want to build for the user. We want to advocate for the user. And for so long, it was just like, hey, you know, something gets pushed out. If the user doesn't know how to use it, then they're just, you know, ignorant or dumb or whatever. And they just need to be smarter about technology. And I feel like there's this wave of, you know, user-centered design and this being like, you know, the thing that solves all app or website or software issues is you just ask the user, you just do it with the user in mind. In your book, you talk a little bit about, you know, some of the shortcomings of that. And maybe you can give us a little taste for your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think like, I don't know, this has happened to me partway through my career, like just kind of like going, I don't know that some of the ways that we understand make good ease of use, I don't know, quote unquote, delightful products is necessarily like having the best outcomes. And one of the examples I use in the book is infinite scroll. Like, so, you know, anytime you, if you spent any time on Instagram, you know that like an hour passes before you realize like, holy shit, I've spent an hour like scrolling through nothing. And part of that is because it was designed with engagement in mind, which was like really a driving sort of, I don't know, force like within user experience design is like, yeah. How do you keep people engaged? Right. And even Aza Raskin, who was like part of designing the infinite scroll, kind of based on an understanding of like, I guess like behavioral methods, just said at one point, like, I don't know that optimizing that has been actually good for the user or for humanity. Yeah. And it made me, you know, and then you have like, I think Tony Zedell was like one of the initial, like part of the team that created the iPhone, said at one point, like, I wake up in cold sweats, like kind of thinking about what I brought to the world. And it's like, oh, that's kind of a simplistic view. I mean, like, there's lots of good things that have emerged from like the invention of the smartphone. But I think that it didn't feel like we've had the tools to kind of think about harm or potential harm has been part of our story as user experience designers, because I think it was easy for a long time because products were so terrible to be like, okay, we can do a lot just by understanding how someone interacts with something. Like, you know, I think I used the famous example of the IDEO shopping cart. Like, you're just kind of designing things to make the direct experience better and more frictionless. And in the case of software, more engaging, maybe more fun and interesting, more delightful. But there are all these repercussions to kind of making those kinds of decisions, especially when you're designing things at scale. And there's so much software that we're working on now that's being designed at scale. And so I was just kind of like doing a lot of thinking over time about like, yeah, like maybe there are some, I don't know, prompts or something that we can engage in to kind of like get us past this kind of narrow lens that we use, which is like, how does somebody use a product in the moment? Is it frictionless? Is it easy? Is ease of use like actually the thing we should be optimizing for? Is efficiency the thing even that we should be optimizing for? And I think just kind of like starting to think about these things a little bit more broadly maybe helps us, I don't know, it might not help us like avoid all of the potential unintended consequences, but it could make us more thoughtful about like maybe have a little less regret about like yeah. What we're putting out there.
I think there's like a huge distinction that we need to like be cognizant of when we're building products. Like, is this a, you know, a B2B application where it's just literally someone, you know, having to work on this for their job or having to accomplish things for their job, right? And in that sense, it's like, we want to make this as efficient as possible so that they can do their job to the best of their ability and serve their customers well, right? And I think that's a pretty black and white thing. Like, we should, you know, we should help them, you know, reduce clicks. We should help them be able to do this faster. But I think it gets really, really like in a gray area when it is something that's like an entertainment-based like social app where it's like they get money from you clicking on ads or just being engaged longer. And when that becomes their only motivation is to, you know, increase your time spent on site or your clicks on ad pieces, then I think you get into a lot of those really severe potential downstream consequences of, you know, anything from just like phone addiction to eating disorders to anything else, which I think is would serve us very well as a, you know, design community and society as a whole to kind of really think about the implications of these things.
Yeah. I mean, I think to be fair, even the example of like productivity tools can have sort of like repercussions. Like there's so many productivity tools, for example, that have been developed that have actually like in the end decreased productivity. Email is a really good example.
Yes.
Slack is a really good example. And these were like things that were invented to be like, yeah, this is like to make communication more efficient. And what ends up happening is like, how much time, like I have like 1,000 like unread emails in my work inbox right now. And I'm just like, I'm just never freaking going to get to that. But like, I think there's like, yeah, thinking about it in that way as well, right? Is just kind of like thinking like, what are we like, what exactly are we doing and why? Like, what kinds of repercussions does this potentially have? But also, just kind of like using the lens of just efficiency, for example, like, is this better if this is more efficient? I think it's like still a question for me. I did a project once that was where like I was working with a team to kind of potentially redesign a customer service software for an airline for the phone customer service people. So we were like watching the customer service people kind of like do their job, like taking calls and kind of hearing what the customers were interested in and what have you. And it was really interesting. Like the leadership of this organization had some specific ideas. They were like, oh my gosh, the software needs to be less clunky. It needs to be easier to use. It needs to like, someone needs to be able to come in and just like start using the software right away and be able to like take the customer service calls and use the software easily. And we're like, cool, like that sounds like a really good set of principles to orient around. And then we did our research where we were observing people for like 8 hours a day for a week, like using the existing software. And at the end, we're like, don't redesign the software because they were like so good. So people had to go through training. They had to go through like a 5-week training to be able to use the software, but they were so good at using it. Yeah. Like they made it efficient in their own way. It was impossible to understand. I could not understand even after observing for a whole week. You could not sit me down in front of the software and expect me to know how to use it. It was just like a bunch of letters on the screen. There was like all of this gobbledygook. And then like, they were just like shortcut, 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 shortcut. And I think they were terrified of the system being redesigned because they're like, all this knowledge is going to go out the window. I've been using this for years. Can you guys like keep some of it? Like, you know, like they're like catching us on the slide as we're doing the design research. Like you're not going to like redesign this whole thing, right? Because I can't imagine like a faster system than what we already have. Yeah. So like the context really mattered.
That's amazing. I remember in my earlier design career, same sort of thing, like insurance off application took forever to learn how to use this thing. And the individuals who were using it and that we were redesigning it for honestly had about a one on a scale of 1 to 10 of like technical ability of, you know, generalized tech. They've been working in this particular platform for like 15, 20 years. They just knew it like the back of their hand. Like, I just push F12 when I get here. And like, it's not very intuitive, but you've learned it. And it's like, even if we presented the most delightful experience, it would be lots of friction for them because they still have to think about it. Then they have to read.
Yeah.
They have to go through all that cognitive friction of like doing something different that they've been doing. But it's like, yeah, you could onboard someone in like, you know, 3 days if you want, I guess. But it's like, is that more important, or is it more important to like keep the people who have been here productive for 20 years, keep them productive, you know?
Yeah. And that right there, like kind of opens up the conversation about incentives. So it's like the organizational leadership is incentivized. So they're like, training is expensive. Like, we don't want to keep like training people for 5 weeks to use this. It's too expensive. They're not actually working during that time. But then it's like, what trade-off are you making? Because like, then the people, yeah, you might train them in 3 days, but then they'll go through like years of inefficiency in terms of like using this new software. It's kind of like, you know, if you redesign like a pilot's cockpit to look like an iPhone, it'll probably be detrimental, right? Even though it looks great. And probably it's like intuitive in terms of use. It's like you want somebody to be trained and like very skilled at using that kind of interface, and also be really good at it, right? And so I think these are all sort of like, it was a question that I asked in that project was like, well, you'll save money on training, but, you know, are you making a trade-off in that regard? Like if we run them through tasks and they take twice as long from what you're doing now, and then you've spent all this money redesigning the software. And like, honestly, like I came off the project before I really knew what happened in the end. I think they did end up redesigning some of the software, but they didn't redesign it in the way that they thought they were going to, because it was more of like backend system fixes and things like that. And I think that was the right way to go, because like, yeah, redesigning the whole interface would have had these enormous repercussions that they weren't thinking about. And I think in the end, like that's a way of system thinking that designers can engage in their project work. Think about who's incentivized. What is the business model? Like, how does this have an impact on the thing you're being tasked with designing?
That's fascinating. Yeah. Thinking back, you know, over the span of your career, you know, you've seen some different waves of design, obviously been at a number of different places. Are there any like specific high or lows in places that you've been or in eras of design that you've seen that come to mind that you could share?
No, that's a really good question. I mean, like anyone else, well, maybe not like everyone else. I was going to say like, you know, I've been laid off. I've actually been fired. Like, I think one thing in this moment in time that, you know, I probably want to reinforce is like, you will find, you know, for you to UX designers who are out there, and if you've been laid off, you will get back on your feet. And it might be that you get back on your feet in a way that maybe is better or like progresses your career. And that's literally kind of like what's happened to me before. Like, it took being fired for me to kind of like redirect my career in the direction of design research, for example. Like, it was an opportunity I probably would not have taken if it were ever left to my own devices. So I kind of think about these forces sometimes as like doing some good in hindsight, even if the moment it feels terrible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So were you focused on more of a different discipline within design that after that instance kind of shifted your desire to explore some other opportunities or some other fields within design?
Yeah. I mean, I think there was a moment in time where when I was a product designer, where I was feeling like the product design work I was doing just like didn't feel that fulfilling to me. And it might have just been like, oh, all the decisions have been made. They've understood the context. Like, I'm being given like sort of requirements. And it was hard for me to like change course because I was, you know, like in a big organization and I was like feeling kind of unfulfilled by that. And I think like, it was sort of a forcing function that maybe at that point in time, I was a little bit of a failing product designer because I was just like do I really care about this work? Like, I feel like I'm just like doing production-y stuff. And so kind of getting into like the design strategy side of things, it helped me feel like a little bit more empowered. And yeah. I don't think that's necessarily like the case for all product designers. It was just like my experience within the organization where it was. But I think there was a lot of that sort of like feeling of a lack of agency in some of my product design work, like especially at a place like Microsoft, for example, you know, where I'd be like the one designer and I'd be working with like 12 software engineers on like a feature. And I was kind of like, I remember kind of arguing with the program manager about like a certain like flow or whatever, and just being like going into that argument being like, well, I'm going to argue for this, but I know I'm going to lose because I'm like one person out of these 30 people that I need to work with, and they all agree it needs to be done this way because the way they were thinking about doing it requires fewer people hours to build it, you know, like, et cetera, everything everybody is incentivized by. So I think like that was a space that was really difficult, but I kind of liked later on in my career, kind of like the space of design concepting, where it's like, I'm coming up with like the scenarios in which people are going to be using products and services based on the context that I learned about as a design researcher. So that's like an area where I feel like there were fewer boundaries, and maybe like I could sort of like express this sort of like systems level thinking a little bit better. Now I work in like complete abstraction away from that. Like, I'm not really doing any screen concept work. It's more like, what are the frameworks that I'm using to kind of get to a point where products can then start to be realized, which I think is even like a nicer space for me.
No, that's cool. I would be interested in your take on like, so like one thing we use at UX Cabin is like trying to think of things in terms of like jobs to be done versus just like requirements or user stories, right? Because it's like, I think user stories or just, you know, the user asked for this gets you kind of into the potential issue of like the Henry Ford faster horses type of thing. Like,
yeah,
you ask people what they want, they're just going to tell you like, if you can make a faster horse, great. And it's like, I think that's a lot of times what people will like answer, like when you're doing user interviews or something like that. And if you just take that just, you know, at its base, but I think maybe this isn't like fully within what you would consider systems thinking, but just kind of like that broader scope of like, what's the actual job that's trying to be done that the user is hiring the software for? And, you know, maybe systems thinking is like one level over that. It's like, what is the job that they're doing then impacting, and what are the tangential jobs associated with that, and how do they all interact and connect from there?
Yeah, I've talked to the mouse about jobs. You know, in fact, like teams I work with use that framework. And I think it's an interesting sort of like relational way to look at, you know, products and how people interact with them. I think the famous example, right, is like, I want to say Clay Christensen talking about like drinking a milkshake, yes, on the
milkshake
way to work.
McDonald's. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like that milkshake is doing a very different job than, you know, the designers, the computers and the milkshake thought it would do.
Right.
And so, yeah, thinking about things like insight, I think it is in some ways a form of systems thinking, because like you're thinking about the ways that people are incentivized, the way it sort of connects to their latent needs. Which I think good practitioners of like design thinking should be doing, right? Like just thinking about people's latent needs and not asking them what they want. There's a, you know, there's like the famous example of like Homer Simpson's car, where he was like working with like the car design team and he was just telling them what they wanted. And it was like the worst car ever invented in history. And actually, one of my old bosses had a model of that car, like in his office. And it was so funny because I don't know what it had, like a donut holder. I just don't even know. It was like, so it's like really, it's just like a good example. Like, don't ask people what they want. Try to identify what their latent need is based on like what you can understand about their context. So I think that's a function in general of just good design research. Like,
yeah.
if you are understanding people's context in a certain way, you're not going to be like just designing features because people say they want them. Yep. Of course, you know, we see a lot of that happen nonetheless.
Sure. What are some barriers to systems thinking that you see pop up in different companies and different industries?
Yeah, I mean, I'm really lucky to be working in a space like education, because I think for the most part, people are inclined to think about how the system interacts because it's like complex. It's like, you know, your buyers are not even your users. So they're already having to think from a systems perspective on that. And if they fail to do that, then your product is probably going to fail. Like if you're just like,
right,
you know, designing a learning management system to appeal to the IT director of, you know, the giant LA Unified School District, I can guarantee like you're just going to drop that into the lap of teachers to use and they'll just be like, what the hell? This is new. I'm not going to use this. It doesn't like do anything I want it to do or whatever. And then you're just like spending money for no reason because they'll find a way around it. So you in that field, they're automatically like inclined to think about systems. I think one of the barriers is just like time and energy dedicated to analysis. Like I think people think like analyzing and understanding the status quo and understanding things like root cause for problems takes too much time, especially when you have an idea that you're like, this will solve things. This is a magic bullet, you know, like this piece of software, this app is going to like fix it. So we have this like strain of techno-optimism in, especially like in the software industry where we're kind of like, oh yeah, this HR software is going to like solve it all. And it's just like, no, it's not. It's going to actually create more problems within the organization. You're going to have to fix them later. But
it's a great phrase, techno-optimism. I love it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's what, like, think about like any kind of like, I don't know, technology leader, tech industry leader. Like, they basically talk about all the benefits of their technology. But I think they're actually like sort of like tricking themselves into thinking like there's not going to be any repercussions. We're seeing that today with AI, right? It's just like, oh, well, you know, this is going to like move mountains, but like we as a society will need to kind of think about how to solve for it. I don't think like the developers of AI are being like super thoughtful about like how exactly like this could play out in from a negative repercussions kind of perspective. So I think that kind of analysis is a barrier. And I think, yeah, also in the tech industry, it's like that sort of mindset that's oriented around what people think about, like, even if they wouldn't describe it as such, as magic bullet kind of solutions, is also a barrier, because a lot of problems can't be solved by just like one thing. Like it's going to take like many different forms of intervention.
Yeah, that's a really good answer. I wasn't exactly anticipating that answer, but that's fantastic. You know, say you are like kind of a low level, you know, maybe you're a junior or just individual contributor on a project. What are ways that you might be able to bring in systems thinking to your project or your org if you don't have that type of top-down authority?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's okay. One is like try to understand like the existing landscape in which you're designing. So one thing, I have a team who's worked on educational courseware, so digital courseware that's used in higher ed. And one of the exercises that's kind of worth doing is just like understanding like what are the current problems with like the existing way like these courses are taught. And you do a little bit of like analysis so that as you move into kind of like this new format, you can kind of like think about addressing some of those problems. And I have like these various frameworks within the book. The book is actually like divided into three parts, kind of. It's like why you should engage in systems thinking as a mindset. And then there's a section about understanding the status quo. So I talk about like how to do design research and how to model existing systems. And then lastly is envisioning the future. So before you jump into envisioning the future, I think it's worthwhile to do some analysis using things like you know, I talk about the iceberg diagram, for example, which talks about like, these are the things you see in a system, like the top of the iceberg. And then underneath it are like patterns of behavior. There are structures, and then there are mental models that people have. And I've actually used that model to analyze like why an organization is struggling with remote work. And then, you know, you can kind of use that to come up with like ideation around how to solve for it. And then once you do that, you can do something like, I also talk about a model called like the futures wheel. This is more around envisioning the future. And you could say, okay, well, now we're going to make everybody go into the office. This is a very like simplistic example, but like now we're going to make everybody go into the office. What are the potential like radiating effects of that? What are like the repercussions of that? Like people have moved to like Montana, right? Or whatever. They can't come into the office. So they're going to have to leave the company. Like there's just like, this can play out in many ways. And it's real. These are really simple exercises that you can do, like even with your like design team or like your feature team or what have you. And they don't have any sort of singular application except to kind of analyze one, what's going on. And then there's another set of tools to analyze what might happen. And you can do that just thinking about like your product or service as well. So I think one of my goals when I was writing this book is to try to make some of these things that embody a systems thinking mindset accessible for people, like to be able to like, you can actually like do this tomorrow at work if you're like embarking on a project or if you're like starting something. You don't have to be like, okay, I'm going to create a complicated causal loop diagram. It's going to take me 2 months to do it. That's what makes it feel inaccessible, is like, it's so, it lives in this theoretical space for a lot of people. And I think like, designers are already busy, you know, like you're already doing your design job. You don't need to spend 2 months creating a whole separate map that nobody understands in order to like better understand the problem space. You can do that map if it's a form of communication and you're doing it with your stakeholders. Like that's a good use of your time. But yeah, I mean, I think my goal was like, what are some things I can plug in here that people can just like start doing tomorrow? And, very cool. You know, if they want to do it.
Well, Cheryl, this has been a fantastic talk. We are super pumped about your book. We want to get it into the hands of as many listeners as possible. So we're going to be hooking a coupon for anyone who wants to be able to check that out and get it for the Product Design Podcast. We will definitely link that up in the show notes and an easy way to get the book. Thank you again so much for coming on and sharing your perspective. And I will let you have the last word.
Thank you. Yeah, this has been just a super fun conversation. I feel like some things came up for me that I didn't come up before. So I was like, thank you for that. And yeah, I'm really grateful to my publisher, Rosenfeld Media, because they support with things like this coupon. And yeah, I oftentimes speak at their events. So I just wanted to kind of plug that. But yeah, thanks, Seth. This has been really great.
All right. Until next time. Thanks so much for hanging out with us today on the Product Design Podcast. If you enjoyed our conversation, be sure and go follow our guest. Let them know they did a great job and you learned a lot. More to come in the following weeks as we bring on new guests. Please hit that subscribe button so that you will get these podcasts and learn a ton about the product design community. Excited to see you next time. Thanks.